Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will happen sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great.
I am doing the show from fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada this evening.
All right.
So
all right.
That touches upon secondary notes topic I want to get to in a minute, but I was just thinking as I was walking into the place where I'm staying that this place where I happen to be was founded by truly a great American, a real visionary. I'm not going to say he was a good man, but I'm at the Flamingo, and there's a bar here, you know, called Bugsy's Cabaret or something like that. It's named after Bugsy Siegel,
right.
and you think well. You know, there was a real visionary, okay? A Walt Disney caliber imagination. He could look at something and see the potential. You look around, you walk around Vegas today, and, you know, I've been coming here on business for years, and it was pretty outrageous when I first started coming many years ago, but it's just so ridiculous now. This temple, you know, it's the holy city of excess is all I can say of Vegas, right? I mean, it's just ridiculous, right? But I look around and I think, well, you know, that guy had a vision in his mind, and I think the reality has far exceeded even his vision, you know, even what he imagined. But this is the place, you know, on the Strip. This is where it really all started, the whole Strip, and, you know, Caesar's Palace is across the street. They kind of up the game, and then all these other places came along, and it just goes to show you, you know, that some possibilities get realized and some don't. And, you know, I was pondering that earlier. I was thinking, why this one? You know, why did Las Vegas happen, you know, in a world where no doubt there was somebody else at the same time as Bugsy Siegel who had an idea for, I don't know, how we could all be living on Mars by this year or something. You know what I'm saying? Something like that. Right? There were all these possibilities that could have unfolded. So, I don't know. Some of them make it and some don't. Is it the people behind them, you know?
It's an understanding of human nature. People like to take a shot, and that's what Vegas is about, I guess. Taking a long shot. It's a kind of a tax on mathematically impaired a little bit, but you know,
definitely,
you know,
yeah.
But it's built that town, hasn't it? And
Well, the gambling is a big part of it, but anymore there's the dining and the shopping, and of course there's always the drinking and the sex.
Yeah.
Actually, there's some of that going on too, I've heard. You know, it's quite an empire of human folly, I suppose. Fallibility.
One of the last times we went, Phil, I got a quick story and we can move on, but it's my wife is like the queen of the upgrade. Okay, she just talks to anybody, and just it's amazing. We were gonna stay, what's the name of that of the hotel casino that's right next to the it's part of the Eiffel Tower. It has the Eiffel Tower, and it's across from the Bellagio. And so we were staying there, and we were set to be in this room that was going to overlook an air conditioner or whatever. And so, anyway, Sherilyn's talking with the concierge and just, you know, lapping it up and everything. Before I know it, we're in the freaking high roller room for the same price. Corner room overlooking the Eiffel Tower on one side and the Bellagio fountains out of the other window.
Very
it was amazing.
Nice.
Yeah, that's... And we had a great time. I think that was the trip that we saw Jersey Boys and a couple other things. It was a great time. We had a good time.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun to be had here. That's for sure. I guess that's the other reason people keep coming. Well, it's funny you mention that. I got a high roller room too. I don't know how that happened. I don't know.
You talk to the right person, and
they knew I'm connected to Sherilyn somehow. But
maybe that's.
I'm up here on the 24th floor looking out at the, you know, did they have the Ferris wheel when you were here?
No, they did not. They did not.
Yeah, so now Vegas, like every other city in the world, has this huge Ferris wheel in addition to all the other stuff.
Man,
so
I get this incredible
view of the... Yeah, come on back. Try the Ferris wheel. And you know, if you didn't do the Hoover Dam tour while you were out here, you know, it's a great thing with the...
That's worth it too, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, with the kids, absolutely, yeah. So anyhow, what I was going to say is I'm in Vegas, and that has to do with why we missed doing something that I really like it when we do, and we haven't done it in a while, and we missed it by a day. Had our show yesterday been on, and it wasn't because we tried to pre-record it, and there was a pre-recording glitch that wouldn't allow us to do it. Had we done the show, we would have done 5 shows in January. And I always love it when we do 5 shows in a given month. Do you know when the last time we did 5 shows in a month was? Probably not.
Well, how long ago? How long has it been?
It was in October of 2014 was the last time we did that. And then not too long before that.
Well, October is a long month, too, and I guess that's why it just happened to fall that, you know.
It's easier to make it happen in a 31-day month than a 30-day month, that's for sure. I mean, a lot of things have to fall into place. It has to – the first day of the month, right, has to – or the one of the first 3 days of the month has to be the day we do the show. We have to not miss any shows that month, right? I mean, there's several things that have to happen. Now, not too long before that, we were doing 3 shows a week. So, obviously, there were a lot of months with even more than 5 shows. But I was looking, and I couldn't find a month where we ever did 15 shows. That would have been pretty awesome. But but we know back in those days, although those were 3 shows a week, they were really, you know, 1 show a week that aired across 3 nights. But I'm going to look back and see. If not, I think we should make that a goal. We'll plan it out, and one of these months we'll do 15 shows. Don't you think that
– Oh, yeah, make it happen.
The world needs that.
It was fun doing 3 shows a week. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, we might have to go back to that. Well, we tried that last week with a half-hour show, and we were just really rolling, and then we were done. I mean, the nice thing about when we were doing 3 of them a week is like, well, we'd finish one, then we'd do one more, and then we'd do one more, you know. So we could kind of get it out of our system. Yeah, so we might have to look at resurrecting that. That was a lot of fun, wasn't it? Maybe without
the video. Oh, yeah, I'm up for it, man.
Video
let's,
killed
let's,
us right
like half hours,
I believe.
Yeah, we can make it out.
Yeah. The world wasn't ready. I don't know. Anyhow, we've got such a great show tonight. So much fun stuff to talk about here. We're talking about, well, it's kind of a collection of topics related to things that have been happening lately in astronomy. And, you know, if you look at the way things kind of happen in, I don't know, bunches, right, the news seems to... it seems to coalesce around certain kinds of events. Like there've been a lot of celebrity deaths lately. There was a lot of space news, it seems like last year, but mostly around things happening in space, people shooting rockets into space, trying out new rocket things, all that kind of stuff, right? Probes going out into space. Now we've got several stories put together here that don't really have much to do with flying out into space. They're more related to observations we're making of space, right? They're things that we've been learning and or speculating about concerning the universe and our place in it. And they're all kind of, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of high concept stories, huh? Kind of, any one of these three is fairly cosmic repercussions. I guess the first of the three is the least huge, but it's pretty huge too.
Yeah, we build from the first story on. So, you know,
exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So the first story is just merely that there may be another planet in the solar system. You know, no big rah, right? I mean, yeah, that sort of thing used to be considered
cool
big news, but we're all jaded now. What's that?
Yeah, I mean, well, here's the thing. You know, you and I grew up in a time that it was 9 planets in the solar system, by God. And then, of course, Pluto got demoted a few years ago, and now we're
right
at 8. It just, you know, that's, you know, I think I speak for more than a few people to say, you know, I liked Pluto. Pluto's cool, you know. Pluto has a heart on it.
It definitely has a heart. Well, that was one of our big going out into space stories from last year, right? The probe around Pluto, probably the biggest of those, actually getting that up close view of Pluto. And I got to tell you, yeah, especially with that heart on there, with the interesting topography and just the, just seeing it up close and personal. Pluto never seemed more like a planet to me than when we saw it up close, right? I mean,
right.
It feels like a planet. But
it was interesting.
See that
in
May. Yeah, it's not. It's a dwarf planet. You know,
right.
It's a planet with an asterisk. It's a conditional planet. For whatever reason, we don't count it. And so there are officially 8 planets in the solar system. One reason we don't count Pluto is because there are a couple of objects out there beyond its orbit, beyond the orbit of Neptune, that are at least as big as Pluto. And we would have to count them too. So we would still no longer have, you know, it would no longer be a 9-planet solar system at that point. We'd be at about 11 right now. And that's not counting this new object that has been discovered. And this one is a little bit different because when they talk about discovering a new planet or a planet-like body out there in the Oort cloud, out there in the deeper part of the solar system, it's usually something that's been spotted. And, you know, they've done enough calculations, they could say, well, there it is, this is this big, and hey, look at that, it's as big as Pluto, or it's a little bigger than Pluto. We've heard a few of those objects, and then quite a few that are smaller, and you don't hear as much about them. But this one's different. It's different two ways. The first way is that no one has seen it yet. There are no pictures of this planet. And the second way is that this is not a small planet if it's there.
Right. And it might be a bit of an exaggeration to say it's been discovered. We have good reason to believe it's there. It's in order to do what it's doing, and the way they are basically coming up with this is they're doing the math on the way the outer solar system is operating, and saying, you know what, there has to be something else out there causing these planets to do what they're doing. And based on the gravity, we're going to say, you know, that it will have to have. We're going to say it's 10 times the mass of Earth, and 20 times further from the Sun than Neptune. And Neptune, guys, is a long way from the Sun. So,
right.
You know, to even say that that's part of the solar system anymore, you know, that is, you know, that expands our idea of what the solar system is, doesn't it? I mean, it's we're talking trans-Oort cloud stuff here.
Absolutely. It makes the solar system a lot bigger. And I think it draws, it makes us aware of a couple of limitations that we may have had to our thinking that just hadn't occurred to us before. One of those is that we just always assumed, well, if there's a planet out there, we could see it. It turns out that the solar system is so big and it has objects orbiting that are so distant that we can't see some of them, and we can't see quite a few of them, and there can even be big ones out there that we can't see. And I think the other assumption that we made, that there's some kind of progression to how the planets are arranged in the solar system. I know I was taught this as a kid somewhere in some science class, fifth grade or sometime. You know, they pointed out, it's like, well, you have small planets close to the Sun, then the big gas giants in the middle, and then it kind of, you know, it drops off again with Pluto, right? That there was some symmetry there. It's kind of a sine wave, something going on there. And it turns out that there may not be much to that.
Well,
if this
it seems like there's nothing
there,
to that. It seems like there's nothing to it, Phil, based on what we're learning about exoplanets. We got, you know, gas giants, you know, as close as Mercury to their stars now. You know,
right.
And so, I think these systems can coalesce any way they want to. Seems like
that's an excellent point. I guess that one got disproved fairly early on in our discovery of exoplanets. So, but now we've got evidence that is not, you know, it's not true of our solar system even, right? Even the observation that we made about our own solar system turns out to be true, because there's this, you know, very large Earth or very small Neptune, actually not even all that small Neptune out there, way out deep in space, and it raises all kinds of interesting possibilities. Because, again, we start assuming, well, if we can't see it, it's probably not there. This one we can't see. We're detecting it because of gravitational signatures on things that we can see, right, the movements of objects that you can see. And it is very interesting that the objects that are out there are in these very odd orbits. And the astronomers worked on this and kept plugging in different ideas. And finally, the thing that made their orbits make sense was this planet. So this is, you know, that's the reason that we believe it's there. But we shouldn't assume anything about what that means about what's there and what's not there, because, okay, this planet, if it's there, has some other planets it's pulling on that tell us it's there, some other bodies it's pulling on that tell us it's there. What about other planets that are so far out that we can't even see anything that they're pulling on, right? Are they there? Well, they might be. We don't know because, you know, we can't see them and we can't see the effect they're having on anything else. So where we thought we had a really good idea of what the solar system was, and we were just kind of tidying up the corners of defining, you know, how many planets we have, you know, it's no longer a question of, well, is there maybe one more? There could be five more, right? There could be nine more planets out there. We don't know. How far out does it go? We don't know. I mean, there have been surveys of the solar system taken, astronomical surveys that eliminate certain possibilities. And I was reading about this. I actually I did a search over on Quora, and I, you know, the question was, how many more planets might there be in the solar system, or, you know, words to that effect. And it was not an astronomer; it was a mathematician who's taken that question on, provided a really good answer over there. Said that here's what we can say. There's not another star in the solar system, right? Because we would see it. If it was a real star, we would see it. And if it was a red dwarf, we could detect it out to this distance. If it was a brown dwarf out to this distance, we'd get this kind of gravity if it was this large, and so forth. So they can't even eliminate the possibility at certain distances that there might be a brown dwarf out there. Okay, so the sun could actually have another star, you know, small failed star orbiting it that we can't detect, you know, half a light year out. Right, and it could be there. We don't know. It might be there. We can't see it. It would have to pass in front of a star that we're looking at the time we're looking, and us, you know, finally get the, you know, things that have to line up really well for us ever to detect that thing. So there could be a small failed star out there, and there could be any number of gas giant type planets, very large planets that aren't particularly reflective. And maybe that's the kind that show up out there. So we could be living in this really big, dark, cold, empty solar system, and we just happen to live at the very, you know, it's like the ocean, right? And there's this little thin strip of warm water right on the beach, you know, and the rest of the ocean is out there for miles and miles and miles. I'm starting to kind of picture that's what our solar system is. It's kind
of
like,
yeah, we're wading in the lagoon of this huge ocean of what it could be. Well, you know, it makes me think about rogue planets. You know, planets, they're supposed to have no star at all. They're just floating free. You know, it makes me wonder if some of the, you know, what we think might be a rogue planet might just be so far out from their star that, you know, we just don't know which star it's attached to, you know.
Could be, yeah. that's an interesting idea, too. Although you would think if it's closer to our sun than it is to some other sun, wouldn't our sun's gravity attract it and pull it? I don't know. I mean, that's that gets into some hard math at some point.
Yeah.
I would expect you know, there to be an absolute limit to, you know, where a planet can orbit our star in terms of when other stars start pulling on it equally hard. I mean, there's still a huge amount of vast amount of open space around the sun. I mean, the nearest star is 4 light years away, right? So
right.
It creates this almost inconceivably large sphere of space around the sun that could have a solar system in it. But yeah, who knows? These rogue planets, I guess,
well,
are just.
Let's think about this, Bill.
Go
ahead. The orbit around the star for it to be like a stable orbit, right? Has to be pretty fast if it's close to the star, or it would fall into the star, right? In order to be a planet that's, you know, as big as what they're talking about, 10 times the size of Earth, then its year must be huge, right? I mean, or it would escape the gravity of the sun being as far out as it is, right? So it has to be moving at a snail's pace around the sun, or the sun would lose it as a planet.
Right. Well, it's moving slowly, but it's traversing a great distance, right? So I'm not sure to what extent those two offset each other, right?
Okay. The article we're looking at, I just caught this here. Would have to be between 10,000 and 20,000 years. Okay.
Wow.
That's a big year. That is a long year. So,
you know, last year on that planet, there was no human civilization, right? That's how long their year is.
Exactly.
That is a long year. So, I don't know. That's interesting. I look forward to us learning more about this. It makes me think, in addition to the fact that we got this whole galaxy to explore, there's a lot more to be discovered about our solar system. And I think there's implications probably for the commercial development of space, which we've talked about. You know, we've talked about the resources that we know about in the asteroid belt and so forth, but gosh, there's whole planets potentially out there. Who knows what riches lie out there beyond our ability to detect them. There could be all kinds of wonderful things.
Looking forward to learning more. I agree with you completely, Bill.
And I'm sure, you know, ruined alien, you know, planets and, you know, all kinds of, you know, that sort of stuff. Well, speaking of aliens, right? Let's move on, because we need to talk about. I got a question for you, Stephen. I'm just going to ask you flat out, okay? And I'd like a straight answer, okay? If I could have one, Stephen.
I'll do my best.
Where are the aliens? Okay, right. That's the question.
What have you done with them?
Yeah,
I promise you, it's not my fault.
Because I left
them
right here.
I like E.T. as much as the next guy, okay? I mean, I cried at E.T. I didn't do anything to the aliens, I promise. Where are the aliens? Well, this is Fermi's paradox, of course, is what Phil is talking about. And it's the idea of, well, you know, if life arises, you know, kind of as a matter of course, which is, you know, what scientists have, you know, kind of thought, then, you know, where is everybody? And so, you know, basically the answer to that is there's got to be filters that keep an interstellar civilization from rising up. Now, the question is the filter ahead of us, Phil, keep us from, do we destroy ourselves before we move out into the galaxy, or is the filter behind us somewhere? And so
when you say a filter, what you're saying is there's some force out there, something that happens that prevents life from flourishing into interstellar civilizations that could then reach out and find us, right? The reason we haven't seen any aliens is because they hit this filter. In other words, life is potentially blooming all over the universe, but it hits this wall. And it blooms no more, right?
It could be as simple as interstellar distances, Bill. I mean, it's just a hard thing to go from one star to another. You know, I mean, it's a long way. Cosmic radiation. It's just a tough trip. You know, it might just be simply that, you know?
Yes. It could be that. It could be that it's not common and that we're first. But if you start with the assumption that we're not that atypical, and so far, you know, there's good reason to believe we're not that atypical. I mean, there was a time not that long ago when we didn't even know for sure if there were other planets in the galaxy. Well, that question has been well answered, right? It appears that there's almost always planets. If you find a star, you find planets. So we always knew this. Well, we're kind of an average-sized star, and we're, I don't know, kind of a small planet, I guess, compared to what we learned about planets. But, you know, within the norm. So there's a lot of stars out there. There's a lot of planets out there. There's a lot of the, you know, basic chemistry that made life.
Yeah, we have every reason to believe that there's lots of water, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, all the stuff
there's water elsewhere, even in our solar system. So, you know, everywhere we look is, you know, there seems to be water. So, you know, that's water is, we understand that water, our understanding of, you know, life as we know it requires water. And so, but everywhere we look, we see that. And so, and
right.
There's, you know, the basic building blocks of life, amino acids and things, we find that pretty much everywhere. I mean, comets and everywhere. So, you know, we would think, well, you know, if this, you know, if life kind of arises from all this fairly commonly, then, you know, where is everybody? And that's the big question. So what's the new
situation?
Why
haven't they come here? Why haven't they sent us a signal? Why can't we point our telescopes out in space and see evidence of them? Where are they?
Right.
And the answer is, potentially, there's a filter. Something happens. And the most prominent notion for that filter that I remember hearing when I was first introduced to that idea is that filter is somewhere just beyond where we are. And it makes sense that we would say that, right? Because why would we ever assume that, you know, we've cleared the filter if nobody else does, right? So if there's a filter out there,
also some Cold War paranoia as well, right?
Well,
absolutely.
You know, or environmental paranoia.
We're going to destroy ourselves with these nukes. I mean, you know, that's pretty much what we grew up fearing. And,
or in the 70s, there was also, we'll just, you know, ruin the earth with pollution and kill ourselves, right? So you have both of those possibilities. We'll just destroy the earth with our greed and short-sightedness, or we'll blow each other up with nukes. But that's the filter, right? Civilizations they reach a point of technological development where things get out of hand. They can't control the power that they've given themselves, and they destroy themselves. That we aren't quite at that point, but we're almost there. And chances are we won't pass the filter since nobody else does anyway. So that's the gloomy, very sad, why isn't there anybody there? It's because we're next kind of way of looking at it. And I guess there's some good news, bad news to this new thinking about the Fermi paradox filter.
I think it is all good news, Phil. What our good friend, he's been on the show a couple times, more than a couple, George Dvorsky, he wrote for Gizmodo this article, New Solutions of Fermi Paradox Suggests That Alien Life Goes Extinct Early. And, basically it's a scientific paper, it's come out basically a new analysis, basically saying, hey, you know, it could very well be that the filter is behind us. And, for example, there was a crisis, in our distant past here on Earth where, a poisonous gas was being pumped into the atmosphere at an alarming rate and killed off nearly all the life on Earth. And that poisonous gas was called oxygen. Okay.
Right.
And,
right.
The life on this planet, came
That's
to a
us.
Balance.
We,
on that.
You can say we about
yeah,
that,
you know,
I think.
Yeah. Our ancestors, came to a balance, and that was, you know, animals breathe in the oxygen, exhale the carbon dioxide that the plant life needs, you know, and they take in the carbon dioxide and release oxygen. So we came to a balance on this planet, but maybe that's a very unusual, Phil, you know, that we were able to come to a balance. And also life tends to insulate the planet so that it doesn't have the same extremes in heat and cold. And it seems like our planet was able to reach that that point of stability quicker than, you know, you would expect normally. And if that's the case, then, you know, life may arise all the time, but, you know, it gets snuffed out within, you know, pretty quickly, either by something like the oxygen crisis or just a failure to stabilize the climate fast enough.
Where the older model talked about, it's interesting, they both rely on these kind of runaway processes, right? Things that go amok and get the better of us. But there are probably more of those that just occur naturally as a result of life showing up, or that just occur naturally in parallel with life showing up that could wipe us out than, you know, we're likely to come up with after the fact. So when you think about it, it sort of makes sense that the big, big filters would lie in the past. That the real hurdle, if the real hurdle isn't life showing up at all, which, you know, is going to be a pretty big hurdle in its own right, every one of these, you know, getting to multicellular stages and, developing a spinal cord and, you know, developing a nervous system, each of these things is potentially a filter, right? Each of these things that we went through, you might either just plateau off and never get to the next one, or you might just get shut down before you can get to the next one. And the idea that really what's happening is very early on, you've got this situation where life is fragile, and it hardly ever makes it to the point where it can hang in there. It makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, it almost seems like evolution would kind of insist that that's how it would work when you think about it. But if that's the case, then yes, it's great news for us because we've cleared the filter, and in my telling just now, we've cleared numerous filters along the way, right? But it's bad news if we're hoping to find anybody out there, right? Because what does that do to the chances that anybody else is out there?
Yeah, that would mean that they would have had to clear all the same filters, and, you know, it might be that the chances of us arising, are very, very low. You know, I mean, it's what's the equation, Drake's equation? It was used by Carl Sagan most famously, and he plug in numbers and say there should be millions and millions, or maybe billions and billions of civilizations.
Literally billions,
literally billions and billions of civilizations in this galaxy alone. And, but it was the numbers he plugged in were all based on assumptions we have absolutely one, and this is based on one observed civilization, our own, right? So, if you plug in different numbers, you might come up with there's one civilization in this galaxy if you plug in different numbers. So, it may be something like that. We just don't know enough. And, if only, Phil, we could look out on our galaxy and see some evidence of something else happening. You know, I mean, if only, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It would answer a lot of these questions. Of course, the more I think about it, I guess the most pessimistic thing you could say is that the fact that the great filter may lie in the past doesn't mean there aren't other filters out there in the future, right?
Yeah.
So it could be literally did beat the odds, a thousand times over. In getting to where we are today, and still haven't bumped into the one that's going to take us out, which still could be nuclear war or something. I mean, you can't completely rule that out. So it could be that, or the singularity. I mean, the gray goo scenario. I mean, there's plenty of different potential future developments that could be as lethal as what might happen to fragile primitive bacterial life in the very early stages. So the other thing, the other thing that can happen is that if you do happen to make it, you still don't make it to the interstellar stage. And of course, my final, most cynical one is that there's one group that made it, and they decided nobody else gets to, right? So there's this, like, reverse prime directive. They're out there looking. As soon as anybody starts making moves in that direction, boom, they're gone, right? That's like the final filter, right, whoever these evil aliens
are. They look at us, and they're disgusted. You know, we're made of meat, and that was the...
That's right. We gotta go. Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, that one is, you know, that's kind of cynical and it's almost kind of comical, because you'd really like to think that if you get that far advanced, you have better things to do, right? That you're not really threatened by anyone else coming along because they're going to be so far behind you, and you know, you probably have other things to focus on, and that's what leads to one of the other much more positive scenarios for where everybody goes, is the transcendent hypothesis. The idea that, in fact, a lot of civilizations, I should say, do clear those early filters, and then they get to these middle filters of self-destruction through environmental and war factors and all these different things. They clear all those. They, you know, they avoid the evil aliens, whatever it takes, and they get to a point where post-singularity, they're at a point where they have an incredible understanding of the workings of the universe, and they have incredible resources at their control. And essentially, they just step out of this universe altogether. You know, whether they go down into, you know, Planck space or up into another dimension, or they're just living on tiny little servers that we can't even see, right? And the reason we don't see them is because they're having a blast in their own little universe that they've created that has such a small footprint that we can't even begin to detect. So that's a much more positive, you know, where they go. They all lived happily ever after kind of scenario for what happens next. And that's the one I'm hoping, most closely maps our future. If we can continue passing the filters, because I guess in a sense, would you define that as a filter too?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like you say, it's the happiest of all filters. That it's just that the thought of venturing out into the galaxy is of little consequence, and they transcend in some way. So, you know, if they're going into Planck space or something, Phil, if they're shrinking down, it could very well be they're everywhere and we just don't know it. You know, so
that's right.
Who knows?
Yeah. The aliens are all around us and not interested in us because, they're having a great time. So I think it's a real interesting development. I want to see how thinking on this subject continues. But meanwhile, I guess, you know, this can bring us to our third story tonight, which is it possible that we've actually, in the last few months, come upon some evidence that there's someone out there who has passed the filter, that there is a civilization out there in space that is alive and well and doing very large things. This is a story in Gizmodo called "The Case of the So-Called Alien Megastructure Just Got Weirder." And of course, we've been talking about this. We did a show about this. I don't know. Couple months ago, I would say, the star is called KIC 8462852, and it's unusual. It's unusual because our view of it is, what's the word, occluded, blocked, by something. We don't know what it is, but what it's blocked by is not like a planet. It's not like we look out there and we say, oh, look, there's a planet going by that star. Look out there and say, say there's a very large mass of something that is irregular and uneven and blocking the light of this star in a most, most peculiar way. So discussion began at once as to the obvious solution. Isn't this clearly aliens out here? In fact, we talked when we did a show about this a couple months ago. We talked about the possibility, you know, are they in the process of constructing a Dyson sphere, a sphere completely surrounding their star? These are, you know, aliens with incredible technology, technological resources at their disposal. They're conducting a huge engineering project, and they're actually, you know, building a shell around their star. And Stephen, I believe when we talked about this, you said that that's not likely, but that there is something almost as incredible that could be happening. What would that be?
Well, it's not likely to be a Dyson sphere because we, from what what we believe we understand, Dyson sphere, like what we would, what we've imagined and seen in science fiction shows like Star Trek: The Next Generation. There was an episode that showed a Dyson sphere. It was the episode with Scotty. If you're interested, you look it up. You know, when Scotty showed back up, right? That particular episode showed this big sphere that was surrounding its star, and on the inside of the sphere was a, you know, was a livable space that, you know, encompassed the entire star, which, you know, would, you know, be amazing, right? Well, we don't believe that a structure like that could exist. Just the there's no tensile strength of anything we could even think of theoretically could handle the gravity of a star and not, you know, crush in on itself. So what could it possibly be? Well, a Dyson swarm would be one answer, and that is you've got so many solar collecting energy, you know, panels perhaps, surrounding a star to collect all the energy the star has, that at some point it's just blocking the light of the entire star to the rest of the galaxy. And so what we saw and what we're seeing here is actually, and the reason it's gotten weirder as than what we thought a couple of months ago is that there was a LSU professor. I always, you know, when LSU does something awesome, I got to pump it a little bit.
Well, listen, so, I mean, we got instant credibility. It's LSU.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I'm gonna buy it, yeah.
So the room goes
quiet,
so we can hear what he says.
That's right. That's right. When he talks, they're going to listen. So anyway,
that's right.
He went back and looked at...
Oh, by the way, we should say that's Louisiana State University for anyone who doesn't know what LSU is.
That's right. Yeah. Gosh. Come on, guys. All right. Anyway,
you should know that, but in case you didn't know that,
that's right.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, he went back and looked at old photographic plates going back to the 19th century. And over the period of time of the last 100 years or so, the light has from that star dimmed 20%. And,
wow.
Over a 100 year period, the light from that star has dimmed 20%, and it's being occluded in a really weird way. And you know, arguments are being made as to why this couldn't be alien megastructure. The one that I've heard most often, Phil, is that we would expect for it still to be radiating heat energy. You know, even though the light's being blocked, we ought to be able to, you know, it ought to be heating up these panels or whatever it's orbiting it, so that we would see, you know, we would see the heat, and
right.
We're not seeing it. It's being blocked completely, and and my answer to that is, well, you know, we don't know exactly what, you know, if this is aliens, we don't know what kind of technology is being used here, so. Just because it doesn't quite meet with our expectations, if we see something this weird, doesn't mean it's not aliens. One thing they pretty much ruled out, Phil, is, you know, it's not like a massive comets or something, because everything we understand about comets, you know, there can't be that many comets around a star to block out.
Right.
Right.
It can't be planets, because planets aren't just constantly changing shape. Right, that doesn't make
any
sense.
Right,
and if it were comets, it would be a behavior. If I can use that word, that's not accurate, but you know, it would be a comet phenomenon unlike any we've ever seen, and not at all lining up with the way we've known that whole, you know, orbital stuff to work at all. Right, so it's something very strange.
Right.
The alien explanation, some will say, you know, is just uncalled for, that you don't have to go out that far out on a limb. But if you don't go that far out on a limb, you're still left with a big question mark as to what exactly is happening here. And I want to go back to the star getting down.
The other thing is, Bill, would you expect comets to increase so that 20% of the light of the star is dimmed over 100 years? No, I mean, comets are there forever, right? And so, what you would expect to see if an alien civilization was building a Dyson swarm to surround its
right.
stars, you would expect to see the light dim over time, and that's what we're seeing. So,
but
I
have to suggest, Stephen, that you may be misapplying Occam's razor there, because we don't know that 100 years of dimming is necessarily caused by the same phenomenon we're seeing here, right? I mean, logically, you would think it is, but it could very well be because other stars dim, right? And now we know sometimes when they do, it's because a cloud passed in front or, you know, whatever, right? There's various various things that can make that happen. So it could be that just coincidentally the star has been dimming. But, you know.
Well, you know, Phil, okay. I'm not
now,
saying it's alien.
Correctly applying Occam's razor, we got to say, okay, but the most likely thing is this stuff that we already know is blocking it, right? That somehow that has something to do with it. I'm sorry, you were going to say?
I said, you know, Phil, I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens, right?
Well, that's
you're right.
It's like, okay, the star's been going dim, and we know something's blocking it now. Okay, technically,
right.
We can't prove that what was dimming it 50 years ago was this, because we couldn't really see it. But that's good evidence. I mean, it's good circumstantial evidence that whatever this phenomenon is has been increasing, right? Whatever's blocking it now started back then and has only gotten more so. And when you try to apply normal, conventional household astronomical phenomena to explain this, it just doesn't add up. Comets don't make any sense. Over a century, this big swarm of comets, you know, just got bigger. It's like, you know, what is it, like a beehive of comets happening up there? I mean,
it just doesn't work that way, does it?
Yeah.
So,
even when you talk about it, you start using words that sound like you mean something that's alive, something with some intention, something with behavior, you know, rather than astronomical phenomena, which don't have any of those things.
I'm going to tell you, another argument against it being aliens that was brought up is that, no civilization could occlude their star as much as what we're seeing here over a mere 100 years. And here's the thing, here's the thing. We're not taking into account, self-replicating nanobots, right? I mean, if they've got their own, Drexler, right, coming up with ideas of, okay, here's what we do. We make these little nanobots that go out and they take the raw matter that they find and rebuild it into something to harvest light energy that we can use for our, I don't know, virtual civilization that we're building. And then as they build, and one of the things they do when they're building these panels or whatever, they're also building more of themselves and surrounding the star that way. So anyway, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that the objection that they couldn't have done that much in 100 years assumes like we know anything about what they're capable of doing. Right.
Right.
And besides, we only have data for the last 100 years, maybe. Right. The star would have decreased its brightness only by 3% over the previous 100 years, right? As the project was really starting to ramp up. Well, we don't know, right? So I mean, it's like Kurzweil talks about these projects that are increasing exponentially, and when you've gotten to 1%, you're halfway there, or however it is he explains it, right? Because the rest of it falls into place really quickly. Now, I'll tell you one thing. If it goes down another 20% in the next 5 years or something like that, next 10 years, I'm going to say we're on to something with the alien theory. I think the alien theory definitely grows legs based on what happens with this thing over the next few years and over the course of our subsequent observations of it. Now, when we pre-recorded this show, I have to go ahead and announce that we had a special guest on who's not able to be with us tonight, and he lent a lot to the discussion, I must say. That was your son, Timothy, who has some very distinct ideas about, you know, not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. And one of the things he suggested was that this could potentially, among other things, be a way of an alien civilization announcing itself to the rest of the universe. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I think maybe, but I'm going to tell you, it's it would be a little foolhardy in a way. You know, it's my way of thinking. You do this not to announce yourself. You do this to power your civilization. And why necessarily would you want to announce yourself? But it's true though. If these are little green men, we have now noticed them, and we are going to keep watching this star. You know that this star is going to be something that people study from now on, Phil, until we have an answer one way or another.
Yeah.
Imagine
a civilization that's on its way to the transcendent hypothesis we were talking about earlier. You know,
right.
they have tremendous resources at their disposal, and this isn't even actually their star. They're at another star nearby, but they're going to use this one, right? And they're living there in their little, you know, Coke can sized universes, you know, which have everything they want. And thought, well, let's see if we can, get the attention of any other life that might be out there. Sure, we could shoot ourselves all around the galaxy, but let's send up some semaphores. And so we'll build, you know, we'll use nanobots, and we'll build big structures around this star. We'll start blinking the star on and off. We'll send some Morse code out, their version of it, right, and see if we can get anyone's attention. Now, I think you raised an excellent point, which is, you know, what would the possible motivation of doing something that huge for something that speculative be? And here I am, you know, to answer that question, imagining a vastly advanced civilization just kind of toying around.
Well, it may not be speculative to them. I mean, and coming back on Timothy's side of this, it may not be speculative to them. They may know for a fact that, hey, there are lots of civilizations out there, and we just hadn't met everybody, and, we're here. Be friendly. Say hello.
Any other possibility? I got to mention this. I have to mention this, okay? Because this brings us full circle, all right? This could be the work of that one civilization that made it and that's looking for the others to take them out. So it's like they plant their little semaphore, you know, Admiral Akbar, right? It's a trap, right?
It's obviously a trap, yeah.
they're baiting us, right? They know that as civilizations advance, they're going to look out into space, and so they start occluding the star with their nanobots or whatever, and you get really interested. You're like, oh, there's a civilization there. We got to go check it out. And then they detect us coming, and at that point, they've got us. I don't really believe that's the case, I want to say, before, you know, we start developing the wrong kind of listenership for this show. I think that's vastly unlikely. But it just goes to show you how these different ideas all kind of tie together in interesting ways. We really don't know what's going on out there in the universe. We don't know who else is out there. And we don't even know what's going on in our own backyard in the solar system. There's an awful lot yet to be learned, I guess. That's what astronomy is teaching us indirectly through the things that we've been learning over the last few weeks, isn't it?
It's just there's so much to learn, and, man, we just need to get out there and learn it. And so, Phil, I want to just suggest a movie to you. If you hadn't already seen it, you've got to see The Martian. And
absolutely, yeah. I love the movie.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And, my hope is that, stories like that are going to inspire a new generation of young men and women to get out there and learn these things, get out in our solar system and maybe beyond. So, realistic sci-fi. I like it. It hardly seems like sci-fi, that movie. It seems
it was more like just a kind of a high-tech adventure story, almost. Yeah.
Right.
It happened to be set on Mars, but so plausible And yeah, I think that's our future, is getting to Mars and going beyond Mars and finding out, you know, maybe solving a few of these mysteries in the years to come. So that's a big thing to look forward to. All right, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Our music tonight is Burning Bright by John Mauer.
John Mauer with Burning Bright. Well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thank you also for these awesome topics. Thanks to Timothy for being with us on the pre-recorded show, and we'll have to have him back again sometime when everyone can hear him. We will be back again next week, I believe, now again on Monday night, with an all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.
On your field now, an early winter, all your red reflecting roses will sit black. You were staring at the ocean beyond the cliff edge, or the face you had forgotten staring back. You don't know where you've been. There's a darkness on the hillside close. From the night, there's a candle in my window, burning bright. All the owls in your oak trees ask stupid questions, 'cause you know for whom exactly they ring the bell. There's a ship on the horizon, it's coming for us. There's a fire on the mountain raising hell. You don't know where you've been. There's a darkness on the hillside closing in. If you can't outrun the night, there's a candle in my window burning bright. Closing in. If you can't out from the night.